Good evening to you all, and thank you for coming. My wife and I were staying overnight in the Edgar Allan Poe room of a bed and breakfast in Guthrie, Oklahoma. Why Edgar Allan Poe, we wondered, in Guthrie, Oklahoma? Well, we were in Guthrie, Oklahoma, so anything might make eventual sense. Poe's father, John Allan, had known a Jean Guthrie back in Scotland. That was the only Poe Guthrie connection I was aware of. But we soon divined the answer. The bed's springs squeaked. Meek, they screeched when my wife rolled over. Cringe, they groaned, if I did. All night, meek, cringe, meek, cringe. A very Poe-ish effect. Terrifying. Guests were expected to write comments about their stay in a little book provided on the bedside table. Since the bed had been shoved into a corner of the room, there was only one bedside, and to reach the left edge where I customarily slept, I had to crawl, cringe-a-ringe. It seemed I couldn't make a meek. Across the bed to the opposite wall, where wallpaper roses in military rows were profusely depicted. In the book, opinions about the springs were plentiful, some of which I read aloud to my meekly cringing wife. The jokes were exactly of the kind you might expect. I wrote more jests in a similarly doubtful taste. It occurs to me now that within bed and breakfasts all over the country, there are little blank books filling up with such ribald and otherwise entertaining remarks. Not all about bed springs, of course, some about washstands and chamber pots, stuck doors, uneven floors, and the ghosts who jangle wires in closets. Nigh on to an infinite number of jests, of course. I had always suspected that if you read often enough in the right novels, you would sooner or later find your life explained. Not all at once, mind you, but this wry bit of it made even more painful in a page of Trollope, that patch exhumed and annotated by Balzac, another part put to sleep by a dull stretch of Hawthorne, moments of morality explicated by paragraphs of Henry James, wet crossings toweled dry with the help of Conrad, and nights of love anatomized by the Marquis de Sade. Meek night was a night you try to forget. But that became impossible, because when I reached page 491 of the galleys for David Foster Wallace's recent novel, Infinite Jest, kindly signed by the author, the intolerable events of my and my wife's night in Guthrie became only too comprehensible. I wasn't exactly surprised by the book's bed-squeaking passage when I read up to it, since the immediately preceding pages had been peeped with squeaks, from unoiled hinges, from wheelchair wheels, from a thread pulled from a pair of pants. Harold Incandenza's father had finally become fed up with his bed, whose existence he blames on Harold's mother by her sentimental insistence that they bring it with them when they moved. The language of the text purely and beautifully reflects father's hunt for the offending squeal, and I'm going to quote now. My father was bent all over my parents' large bed, which was stripped of bedding all the way down to the mattress protector. He was bent over, pushing down on the bed's mattress with the heels of his hands. The bed sheets and pillows and powder blue coverlet were all in a pile on the carpet next to the bed. Then my father handed me his tumbler of tomato juice to hold for him and got all the way on top of the bed and knelt on it, pressing down vigorously on the mattress with his hands, putting all his weight into it. He bore down hard on one area of the mattress and then let up and pivoted slightly on his knees and bore down with equal vigor on a different area of the mattress. He did this all over the bed, sometimes actually walking around on the mattress on his knees to get at different areas of the mattress, then bearing down on them. I remember remember thinking the bearing down action looked very much like emergency compression of a heart patient's chest. I remember my father's tomato juice had grains of pepperish material floating on the surface. My mother was standing at the bedroom window, smoking a long cigarette and looking at the lawn, which I had watered before I ate lunch. The uncovered window faced south. The room blazed with sunlight, unquote. As wise as Stein concerning repetitions, the passage bears down here, pivots, bears down again, walking on its knees to another spot where it bears down some more. I deny that the scene bears any sexual suggestion. But there is a lot of bearing down until the squeak, hardly hearable, is found. Now, the music of the language is equally informative, as is the quite characteristic diction, slightly stilted, somewhat distant, as in pepperish material. Also worth admiration is our author's careful push-by-push attention to detail. But timing is everything, and the passage concludes its movement with a triumphantly irrelevant aside. My mother was standing at the bedroom window, smoking a long cigarette, and looking at the lawn which I had watered before I ate lunch. At such moments, I put down the book to applaud. I had a high school teacher everyone called Miss Bedsprings because she was always rising to tiptoe when she talked and then singing mid-sentence back on her heels, up and down, as if her body were breathing, which I suppose it was. Well, anyway, the mattress is wrestled away, the frame finally exposed, and all the accumulated dust beneath as well, before the scene comes to its slap-sick conclusion. This novel passes through moment after miserably empty moment of American life with graveyard hilarity. Hence its title, I suspect. But it isn't a resurrected and freshly fleshed Yorick who speaks the book, but Yorick's skull. It pours from his fallen chap. And the work has an Elizabethan interest in doom and in decorum, in the raunchy, the weird and insane, in general wild-headedness, and the language is also young and vibrant and courageous and button-bursting. Critics say that David Foster Wallace is the funniest or the liveliest or most giftedest of his generation, but I believe his generation had better start running if it hopes to keep up and keep him in it. Sure, he serves aces, he lobs and smashes, but here is a backhander of verve and viciousness. Words will whistle past you and baseline dust will puff. The advantage will always be his. In David Foster Wallace's work, genres collide without anyone getting hurt. There are a zillion characters, most of them living under assumed names. Many of the girls, or almost young women, are allowed to use very bad language and date bums, though they are brilliantly drawn, I guess. How would I know? I was only a girl for a month, and that was in Ohio. Moreover, you may run into Lyndon Johnson and other unpleasant types, not all, fortunately, out of office. This language level is high, low, and intermediate all at the same time. He has no respect for decorum and will allow Mondrian to occur in the same sentence as dumpster. Page 577. There are frequently sudden changes in font character and type size, most disconcerting, and he knows how to disorder a story in new ways. He is perfectly capable of concluding, or leaving off, an action in mid-action, the way the title piece of his collection, Girl with Curious Hair, given to us in a masterful, semi-stilted, out-of-kilter diction that is funny, lamentable, and frightening. More frightening to some is the fact that David Foster Wallace's first novel, The Broom of the System, appeared in 1987 while he was still in, or just out, of graduate school. He smartly used the broom of the system to sweep up a Whiting Award, the Paris Review Prize, an O. Henry and New Voices Award, as well as a Lannan, which some of us have had to wait a bit longer to receive. The MacArthur Grant was almost an afterthought. The young are often brave until they learn how dangerous bravery is. And Mr. Wallace will go on cruises and attend state fairs in order to bring back the truth alive and squirming in his notebooks. The title essay of his stimulating collection, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, will keep you from shooting skeet. After all, what have they ever done to anyone? Advise you on the wear of formal wear and prevent you from getting food poisoning on some supposedly fun cruise, which, if you read the piece, you'll not be inclined to do even once. But we must get back to the squeaking bed frame, or bed springs, or protesting mattress, lest it be thought we have no sense of form. I think of our culture, and not just the pop cults of the young, as lying flat in front of him, and David Foster Wallace's prose palping it, bearing down here and there until we clearly hear a reek arise, a squeak of protest, a squeak of pain, a squeak which produces knowing smiles, a squeak of mouse-made fear, a squeak of disuse from unoiled joints. Then the mattress is removed, the springs pushed off, and through the frame, all the dust, all the ruck that remains beneath the bed can be plainly seen. He makes you want to run for the vac, if not for your life. Despite the fact that David Foster Wallace loves tennis and takes a serious interest in David Lynch, I want you, anyhow, to welcome him to Washington University and the International Writers Center. He deserves something good to happen in his life.
Okay, now I'm really nervous.